And greeting friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong from West Berlin with the good news of the world tomorrow. This world today isn't filled with very much good news. Rather, it's a world of division, of strife, of political headaches and intrigue. It's a world of political misunderstanding, of potential race violence, a world of economic disaster, a world of poverty, and, as shocking as it sounds, a world of impending starvation. A world where, in spite of our mechanical and technological progress, fantastic numbers of millions of people may die in the next few years because of lack of food. With impending starvation in India, with the tremendous problems of a sprawling Asia with its multiple millions of people, with the increasing drought in Australia, with the increasing problems of upset weather in the United States and other parts of the world, this is not a really happy world in which to live. And I have just returned from a visit to one of its unhappiest places, a place where I looked in vain for a long time before I saw a smile, to East Berlin. That divided city, that other half of this tortured and torn city that remains as a festering sore on the face of this earth, and a place you need to be watching. There is a tremendous contrast between East and West Berlin. First of all, the population is double here in West Berlin, that what it is in East Berlin. It's slightly over 1 million there and over 2 million here. But the contrast is far more startling than that. There are only two or three streets where you could say there are any really new, big, and modern buildings, and even those are not the same quality as you see here in West Berlin. And yet I want to qualify that contrast as I tell you just a little bit about it. It's impossible, of course, to describe just in words very much to give anyone a real clear picture and to give you a sort of a radio travelogue. That's impossible. But to say that East Berlin is terribly drab, to say that there are wide streets with just very few cars in many parts of it, that you see people, oh, sometimes six or eight on one block, sometimes you'll go a block or even two blocks without seeing more than two or three people at the most, when you see broad and wide plazas and streets and only a very few people walking aimlessly about. It's a total difference between West Berlin, where you see the hustle and bustle of a glittering modern giant of industry, of gleaming big skyscrapers, and of shops jam-packed with luxury items, and then to see the drabness of East Berlin. Now, I said I was going to qualify that, and I will, because even though East Berlin, in comparison to West Berlin, is drab, yet, nevertheless, it has grown economically in the last few years, and is now well ahead of its other European neighbors. It's just that you can't imagine how vivid is the contrast unless you visit the two and to see for your own eyes the tremendous difference between them. Recently, for example, a leading newspaper in the United States said East Germany, long downgraded as Russia's tightest satellite, could turn out to be the communist country to watch, and as we were commenting on the spot there just recently, it makes no difference under what political regime those people are. They are, nevertheless, Germans. And being Germans, they have a slogan. Maybe you've heard of it in the West. It's called, other people work in order to live. But Germans live in order to work. And you know, there's a lot of truth in that. As we were commenting on the streets of East Berlin just recently, it doesn't matter under which banner or flag or how much political propaganda. And of course, you see a tremendous amount of that. Slogans and banners and just red strips of cloth almost everywhere in East Berlin. It matters not what kind of government is holding them down or suppressing them or ruling them today or under what regime they find themselves. They are, nevertheless, Germans. And they have that German ingenuity and that drive and spark, that irrepressible energy that is going to lead them ahead in all fields of some of these other nations. Now, for example, recently a leading newspaper in the United States said East Germany today is a land to watch, and told how East Germany had been long downgraded as Russia's tightest satellite, and yet it could turn out to be the communist country to watch today for both the Marxist East and the Democratic West. This is not because East Germany is now stirring up a flurry with its bid for United Nations membership. Little is likely to happen over that bid in the near future. Rather, it is the economic potential of East Germany which is even now beginning to gather steam. Now, for example, Herr Frank Schnee, who is the regional editor abroad of the Plain Truth magazine and director of our offices in Dusseldorf, West Germany, was with me on the visit to East Berlin. He had been there just last year, as had our staff photographer, Mr. Lyle Christofferson. Mr. Schnee has visited East Berlin a number of times. He was also surprised. I was beginning to comment, of course, on the drabness, on the sort of a stifled look, on the aimless appearance, on the empty streets and the poorly built Russian automobiles and various things that I could see is a tremendous contrast between the glitter and the glamour of the West and the drabness of the East, the large number of buildings that have still not been cleared away, block after block of rubble, shattered, burnt, twisted old buildings with all types of rusted steel still visible in them, even in spite of the large state-built apartments. But you know, Mr. Schnee said, yes, but there was shocking contrast to him because of the tremendous progress that had been made there in just the last couple of years. For example, right at Checkpoint Charlie itself, where we were just moments before coming here for this World Tomorrow program. He said the entire checkpoint had been changed, that only 1 year ago it took him about twice as long to get through, that 1 year ago the checkpoint was very drab, and you walked up to a very ugly little squat building and you poked your passport through a little window, which promptly went shut, and then you had to wait from 20 to 30 minutes while you wondered what was happening to your passport. Everyone looked at you with an eagle eye, and they were very, very tight-lipped. No smiles there. Now, of course, that part of it is still true. But they have now a building that looks more like a modern little bank, with open glass with a man in uniform standing behind it, and rows of little flowers planted there. It's not a pretty sight in spite of the flowers, with this huge tank trap and this maze of concrete block and all of the guards with their submachine guns or machine pistols and the glittering eye of suspicion that they place upon you. You don't feel very comfortable walking across that no man's land and seeing the guards on each side looking at each other through their binoculars, and to realize that right on this spot the blood of many martyrs has flown who tried to crash that barrier from east to west. Now, of course, a lot of people have falsely assumed that that great big wall is to keep some people from going from West Germany to East Germany. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. That wall is not built to keep people out. It is built to keep people in. And that is a very sad truth which you immediately see when you're on the spot. So the contrast is there, first of all, to the eye of anyone visiting East Germany or East Berlin for the first time. It would look as if it were a nation of absolute suppression and of drab standards by contrast to the West. And yet to someone visiting it again this year who had been there only a year before, it has known a tremendous economic resurgence. For example, right now today, West Germany is beginning to gather steam economically and is sitting squarely in a highly strategic spot in Middle Europe. In the long run, East Germany could become quite as great, believe it or not, an economic, political, and intellectual challenge to Eastern European Marxdom as it could be an economic competitor for West Germany. Now, East Germany has become so strong in her economic development that it is now recruiting workers throughout Eastern Europe, and that indicates that German genius and ingenuity are being geared up there just like they were here in the West much earlier. It's significant, then, that this East German upswing comes at a time when in many of the other communist lands of Eastern Europe, for example, Poland, Czechoslovakia, or Hungary, there's concern over lagging production, over growing economic problems, and even lack of worker interest, and where communism just is not paying off. But as I said earlier, it doesn't matter which regime. Those are German people. And as a result, even though East Germany's economic power and upthrust does not and may never come close to West Germany's, as I said, the contrast is obvious. Yet, when you compare it not with the glitter of West Germany or West Berlin, but when you compare it with the rest of Eastern Europe, then East Germany begins to look more and more formidable. Moscow probably views this with mixed feelings. Obviously, it's happy to see an ally thrive, but it can't forget that East Germany is Teutonic. And another interesting thing about this giant divided city. In East Berlin, there are many memorials that are kept as memorials to remind the populace there of all of the crimes of Hitler, of the Hitlerian era in Germany. For example, there is a monument built to commemorate all the dead that were killed by Hitler in the concentration camps. There are various war memorials of the communist soldiers that are guarding them there, of Russian soldiers, constantly in the propaganda, in the newspapers, in signs and posters and pictures. The East Berliners are reminded of all the atrocities of Hitler. Constantly in East Berlin newspapers, they point out the number of Nazis high in the West German government. They point out the fact that while there are many Nazis in chief positions in the modern-day regime in West Germany, it has not been admitted publicly, that it's played down in Western newspapers, that the Western allies generally turn a deaf ear to such complaints, that they generally try to suppress such news, and that it's hush-hush and no one talks about it very much. And even though it may sound like East German propaganda, that, believe it or not, is true. But the point is, the East German people are made to listen constantly to the crimes and sins of the former German regime. and are keeping this before their eyes because the communist government there of East Germany, and it is a sort of a satellite government, it's not recognized by the United States, which of course makes them feel very unhappy, and the fact that they don't have a seat in the UN makes them unhappier still. But nevertheless, that regime, with the people in the Kremlin pulling the strings, and that is a known fact, it is regarded by the West as a purely puppet regime, even though it has its own claims of being a people's republic and a democratic one at that. Still, the regime of Walter Ulbricht keeps before the East Berliners the facts about Nazism and the possibility of a neo-Nazi revival today. Now, East Germany is a land to begin to watch, but nowhere near so much as West Germany, because here in West Berlin, which is, while not the political capital of Western Germany, nevertheless still the capital morally and, shall I say, spiritually, the one city to which all Germans look as the really big capital city of Germany, and the one which they hope is going to remain as symbolic of the unsettled reunification problem. And yet here, about 21 years after World War II, is one of the largest, best-trained, and most modern armies in all of the world, and the strongest European force on the continent. Today, right here in West Berlin, which should still be prostrate, according to some of the predictions of the leading figures in the world only 21 years ago, here is looming an immense power, immense in NATO defense plans as a bulwark against communism. West Germany looms large in the communist view as a hated enemy and a menace to peaceful coexistence. But most important, she looms large on the world scene as a powerful and frightening question mark. So say leading publications in the West. For example, slowly rebuilding today the German U-boat fleet, which inflicted such heavy losses on Allied shipping. At the present, they're limited to a certain small type of submarine. You may not know some of the factors I'm about to give you about West Germany. You may not realize the paradox of this dwarf and giant. A dwarf in some ways, but a giant in others, which I'll explain. Are her armies too strong today is the question other European allies are asking. Should the German forces receive atomic weapons? Are Hitler's old henchmen back in power in the military? These questions are agonizing people in the Netherlands and in France. Is the new German army really democratic? Where are its real sympathies? These are the questions others in the West are really worrying about today. But believe it or not, some of the old slogans are back here in West Germany, and there are big shifts underway in Europe you need to understand, because what is happening today seems to be a bizarre repetition of history of 1936 and 7 and 8, during the time when Hitler came to power after the collapse of the Weimar Republic. For example, the old slogan, Drang nach Osten, or the push to the east, the room to the east, as they used to say, Lebensraum, is again gathering steam, believe it or not, because the political and the economic offensive in Eastern Europe is really underway. You see, bonds exports to Eastern Europe had jumped by more than 22% the first quarter of last year, and that's almost four times as fast as West German exports to fellow common market countries. Now, you've heard the name Alfred Krupp. And Krupp is the West German industrial giant, the giant among all the industrial giants, the one whose name was infamous as the supplier and manufacturer of much of Hitler's munitions during World War II, of the giant cannons and the bombs and all the rest of it. Krupp today expects to double his exports into Eastern Europe in the near future, in the words of managers of that giant industrial complex. And this pickup in West German contracts with Eastern Europe dates to the day that Bonn, in effect, waived the Hallstein Doctrine. Under it, Bonn, since the early 1950s, had refused to deal diplomatically with any nation that recognized communist East Germany, and all communist bloc nations in Eastern Europe followed suit. This doctrine had been shunted aside back in 1965, and today, the political and economic floodgates are beginning to swing wide open. There is a trend that is gathering way right now, which is going to lead toward the eventual reunification of these divided peoples, this divided city, and this divided nation. Here we are, about 21 years after the close of World War II. And here is the dwarf and the giant. A dwarf geographically. When you look on a modern map, the map that has been so carved up and altered since World War II, the German Federal Republic with 57 million persons is slightly smaller than Arizona, less than half the size of France. And yet it is an absolute giant in production. West Germany today is the world's second largest trading nation after the United States, as shocking as that may sound, and I can document that for you. Can you imagine it? I don't believe the average person in Great Britain realizes that, the average man on the street. Oh, sure, people in economics do. people in business, people in government, people high in business in the management field of some of the large American industries who may have factories in the common market may well know that West Germany is the world's second largest trading nation. But the average citizen in his average rut, in his average everyday way of life, doesn't know it, didn't know it, and probably still won't know it if they hear me say it, because we just can't seem to believe what the true facts really are. A whopping 20% of the world's manufactured exports emanate from the shops and factories of West Germany, believe it or not. And when you count the farm and the raw material exports, West Germany supplies 11% of the world's annual export total. Every sixth automobile produced in the world is manufactured right here. And this nation is now selling more automobiles abroad than any other country on the face of this earth, believe it or not. West Germany, for example, sells as many cars outside its borders as the United States, France, and Great Britain all combined. You may not have known that every 12th ton of steel, every 14th ton of coal produced in the world rolls from West German mills and mines. And of course, one of the really big problems here is not the fact that people are unemployed, but the fact there are nearly 600,000 potential jobs going begging for which they have no workers. And one of the big political problems of this day has been the importing of workers from many other nations, from Spain, from other common market countries. And of course, then others have begun to raise a voice of alarm that many of these other people are beginning to water down the culture, that they'll begin to live here and to intermarry with the German people and so on. And some of the old racism begins to emerge, and some of the right-wing splinter parties begin to take exception to this importing of foreign workers. And yet, even with more than a million foreign workers in this country today, the German economy is still 600,000 short and needs other workers. These and other statistics have been cited in a current survey of the West German economy published by the German Industrial Institute in Cologne. Only 20 years ago, that survey pointed out Germany stood in absolute rubble and ruins, its people about to starve to death, dazedly collecting what pitiful few belongings they could, scraping together the rubble and the brick and the mortar, trying to sweep a path through some of the rubble and the shattered ruins of their cities, like here in West Berlin, where, if you can begin to imagine it, in the downtown districts, the big shopping districts, the banks and all the embassies and the big government buildings, it was 90% destroyed. That means 9 out of 10 buildings. That means so much destruction you can't begin to imagine it at all. And when you take all of the other areas of this vast, sprawling city and put it together, the entire city was about 70% destroyed. Unbelievable destruction. And you don't have to go too terribly far to see certain blocks that are still graced with only a lot of wild grass and a few heaps of rubble and maybe just one shattered wall or an old burnt-out building. Even here in West Berlin, there are still plenty of such buildings around, even though there is tremendous industry and tremendous rebuilding and growth. But here we are today in West Germany, which is becoming an absolute giant in strength, measured against all but the superpowers. And that is the miracle of this modern era. That is the fantastic truth you need to digest and to ask yourself, what does it mean to the future? And where will Germany go in the years that lie ahead? Here is a nation that only 21 years ago lay in absolute rubble, and yet today must be considered side by side and right along with the United States, ahead of Great Britain, perhaps, side by side or ahead of France, side by side with Soviet Russia. So far, the West German people have been preoccupied with building up this strength, their economic resurgence and revival, their industrial capacity, and the manufacture of the goods and the producing of the services that go to make life more luxurious. But how will all this strength be used in the future? This is the great unanswered question 20 years after. No one knows how the West German people may respond when the realization fully sinks in that reunification might be as far away as ever. And maybe there isn't any way to tell right now what will occur here and right at that wall which I visited only moments before. But you can be sure of this. This is a place you need to watch, because what is going to occur in Central Europe is going to shock and surprise millions of people, except those who have been listening to the World Tomorrow program and reading the Plain Truth magazine for these past three decades, because in the Plain Truth magazine, since the early 1930s, we have been foretelling a resurgence of a tremendous power block in Central Europe. Not just six nations, but eventually 10. And basing that not upon any political ideology, not upon any interpretation of German documents or any State Department information, but basing it purely and simply upon Bible prophecy. Now, believe it or not, the Bible is absolutely up to this precise moment The Bible prophecies are coming to pass and unfolding right before your eyes. One-third of the Bible is prophecy, and a tremendous section of that one-third of the Bible is yet to be fulfilled, and the big powers of the world are mentioned time and time again. Communist Russia is mentioned. Great Britain and the United States are mentioned time and again, and you can prove that to yourself when you write for this free booklet on the United States and the British Commonwealth in prophecy. Germany is mentioned time and time again in the Old Testament of your Bible, and what modern-day Germany is going to do is already revealed in advance. Now, you can take that or leave it. You can accept that or disbelieve it, but you need to look into it for yourself and prove it to yourself without just turning up your nose and deciding it's untrue because it seems not to appeal to you. What is happening right here in Central Europe today, we predicted in 1944. We foretold before the end of World War II that Germany would rise again. We foretold a tremendous economic, political, and finally military revival of this prostrate giant of Germany after World War II. People scoffed, thousands disbelieved, others snorted and hooted and got a big chuckle out of it. And yet, continuously, in those years that have gone by since, those prophecies and predictions did come true. And today I'm here on the spot in West Berlin at the very seat of the moral and the spiritual heart of these peoples who have come back to get right up on the pinnacle of the economic strength of the world and to become, again, a world power with whom the rest of this world must reckon. To give you just a few of the most important facts about this new emerging giant of industry and political power, let me give you the words of the former defense minister of West Germany, Franz Josef Strauß. He was against German soldiers for Vietnam because he said we're still suffering today from an international defamation campaign and carry as a nation the stamp criminality. And he meant by this that the first dead Vietnamese would be used in connection with thousands of imagined corpses as new horror campaigns which the world would let loose against Germany. This defamation campaign, he thought, would be believed not only by the communist-dominated world, but also by some of the German allies. And he said the damnation of our German army must first be removed before any international task of this scope could be expected from us. When he was asked about the question concerning General de Gaulle, Mr. Strauss called him a European prophet, but unfortunately with a future tainted too much French. When he was asked about the possession of atomic weapons, he said, "Why should only Anglo-Saxons and Russians be morally worthy to possess atomic weapons? The partnership between Europe and the United States necessitates a European federation with access to atomic weapons." Yes, Germany is beginning to throw her weight around in political affairs in the world once again. And a nuclear-armed Germany with German fingers on the trigger may be in the near future, as unbelievable as that may sound today. Now, today, Germany is still tied in with NATO. What is going to happen in the future if the French president insists on his own plan, his grand design, as he calls it? People aren't really sure as to what's going to happen to NATO. But it has been said by that same former defense minister, Franz Josef Strauss, and I quote his words, "It is high time that the Europeans find themselves and learn to pursue an independent political viewpoint," end of quotation. The former defense minister, Josef Strauss, remember, had to resign his office after Der Spiegel affair, which you may have read about in the United States and in Great Britain. Many people knew a little bit about that, and maybe they didn't know too much, but it was a bizarre case where a sort of a Nazi-like arrest of some of the leading members of a magazine which would be comparable to Time magazine in its influence and its stature in public affairs in West Germany occurred. And as a direct result of this, the defense minister, who had been challenged personally in the magazine, later admitted he had a hand in the arrest, had to resign. Now, however, that same defense minister is making a tremendous comeback. As the publication Zeit said here on April the 8th in 1966, and I quote, "Like it or not, Franz Josef Strauss is making a comeback," end of quotation. There is a German awakening today. For years, the economic miracle represented a kind of occupational therapy, a sort of a materialist escape. And while it remains the dominant fact today in Germany, more and more people find that is not enough. More and more West Germans are impatient and uneasy about reunification. They're afraid that maybe the rest of the world is going to accept a divided, bleeding city and a divided nation as a sort of a status quo of this present era. Remembering the Hungarian fiasco when the Western powers did not come to the aid of the revolting Hungarians when they tried to throw off the communist yoke, that such a thing could occur here. and they are beginning to get a little bit restless. Said Strauss not so long ago, the terms fatherland, patriotism, and national consciousness were so immensely misused during the Third Reich that especially those who did believe in it could not be approached anymore. But he asked, where do we stand now? And this comes from a German publication, Bild, translated from the German language. Where do we stand now, asked Mr. Strauss, can national consciousness be given from the top, or does it have to grow from the bottom up? Or shouldn't both work hand in hand? Hasn't there been with us for years a class of people who have been drawing everything connected with nationalism into the dirt, ridiculing, laughing at it, and belittling it? What I mean to say is, said the former defense minister, we must again pursue our national interests more strongly. We must come out of the maze of the unconquered past. We must free ourselves from the role of the blundering scapegoat. We must finally quit being the object of foreign supervision. Our allies, especially the British, must cease to treat us like their former regiment commanders in India treated their boot polishers. They have to get used to the idea that we are allies and not boot polishers. We must come out of this state of mental bondage, he said. A feeling for reunion has been very pronounced here. Having just returned from East Berlin, I stopped at a little museum just this side of Checkpoint Charlie and saw there all of the pictures and many of the various escape mechanisms that have been used by so many people in their attempts to escape from East Berlin into West Berlin. Everything that stands for freedom and prosperity and the very picture of the progressive West German state is here. While across the border in East Berlin, even though a great deal of progress has been made, those people obviously see the tremendous difference. In that little museum, many pictures, some of them even of dead bodies lying next to the wall. And at this precise moment in world history, that wall still stands as the very symbol of a ruptured people, a divided city, and even a divided world. It's fully expected that General Charles de Gaulle, on his visit to Moscow very soon, is going to bring up the German reunification issue. And, as a matter of fact, received a note not long ago from the Bonn government asking him to bring up the issue of reunification and with it the suggestion that Russia tear down the Berlin Wall as a sign of Russia's goodwill and willingness to lessen tensions in the Cold War. Whether or not that happens, German reunification is nevertheless a very great likelihood in the near future. For over 30 years, we have been foretelling on the World Tomorrow program the ultimate union of not six, but 10 nations in Central Europe, the emergence of a new power bloc, a third power bloc in world conditions, one that is very likely to be called the United States in Europe. And we've also been telling you what that means to the United States and to Great Britain, what that means to Russia, what that means to the entire future course of world events. Because believe it or not, the emergence of a third power bloc, very likely with Germany, a reunified, revivified, and possibly, as shocking as it sounds, a re-Nazified Germany at its head, is going to so alter the course of future world events it will be difficult for you to believe it. But you need as never before to get your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine. You need to write for these booklets identifying the big powers in world conditions. They're entitled The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy, and also the booklet 1975 in Prophecy. And all you need to do to receive these booklets and also the Plain Truth magazine is to send your name and address to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California.